Today on Mr. Media, I'll talk to screenwriter Terry Hayes, whose film credits include three Mel Gibson movies, Payback, Mad Max 2, The Road Warrior, and Mad Max Beyond Thunderdome, as well as From Hell, starring Johnny Depp, and Dead Calm with Nicole Kidman. He's just published his first novel, I Am Pilgrim, and it's a doozy, with a film adaptation already in the works. Stick around and be nice to me, or I'll sick Battle Boy on you and your credit cards. So much media, so little time. Who keeps track of it all? That would be me. This is Bob Andelman, and this is a Mr. Media interview, brought to you by Amazon.com, Audible.com, and 1-800-DIAL-DJs. Please stop by the website, MrMedia.com, click on our advertisers, support the show. And remember, there's more than 1,000 interviews available at MrMedia.com. We've been doing this since February 2007. Hope you'll find something you like. And thanks for listening. Mr. Media is recorded live before a studio audience of fictional characters that seemed a lot more exciting and manageable in my imagination than in my living room, in the new media capital of the world, St. Petersburg, Florida. You can be forgiven if your first thought upon seeing or picking up Terry Hayes' first novel, I Am Pilgrim, is that it's going to be less a soaring adventure than a hefty paperweight. But I'm here to tell you that at 612 pages, yes, 612 pages, it is worth every minute of lifting and reading that you'll invest in getting from the first page to the last. It's that good. Now, this is the stuff of traditional page turners, rugged action, globe-trotting adventure, and can't wait to see how it ends, suspense. Not that the cinematic nature of this intense spy thriller is by accident. Author Hayes has some pretty impressive film credits to his name, including three with Mel Gibson, including Payback, two Mad Max movies, as well as From Hell, which starred Johnny Depp, and Dead Calm with Nicole Kidman. Now, what's noteworthy about Hayes' career, besides the fact he worked with Gibson during the rise of the actor's career, is that as far as IMDb goes, Hayes fell off the face of the earth after writing From Hell in 2001. That, of course, was 13 years ago. Now, did he spend an entire decade writing I Am Pilgrim? If so, it was worth it. But don't worry, I'll ask. Terry Hayes, welcome to Mr. Media.
Thank you very much for having me.
Great to see you. And congratulations on I Am Pilgrim. I mean, it's a fairly remarkable piece of fiction and suspense.
Yeah, thanks. If we could just convince my kids that that was the case, that'd be terrific. If it's not written by Rick Riordan or J.K. Rowling, I don't think they're interested.
How old are your kids?
They range between 7 and 12, so they're right in that age, the age group for those particular novelists. I'm glad that we've moved out of Geronimo Stilton. But I'm afraid I Am Pilgrim is a little bit too mature for them at the moment, so they're not sure that Dad really does write books.
Although some of those J.K. Rowling books are equally as long as this one.
Yeah, it's not the length. I think it's the intensity. And, you know, that's what worries me. Same with movies. You know, the kids haven't seen most of the movies that I've done because, you know, my theory about writing is that you try to put the audience or the reader, whoever, really through the emotional experience. I think it's a bit too intense for kids my age.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, I guess I'd be more surprised if you had them read them and they liked them. Then I'd be a little more concerned, I think. But and
probably,
yeah, probably, you know, when they start hitting college or beyond, they'll start looking at this stuff, or they'll be hearing about it from other people. Wow, your dad wrote this, or your dad did that, and they'll be like, oh, is that important? You know, and then they'll go, maybe I better go watch that movie, or maybe I better go read that book. You know, it's something that happens a little later, I think.
I couldn't agree more. We go down the video shop. You know, they can pick out movies they want to watch for the weekend and that. And to my eternal embarrassment, every now and again, they yell out, "Dad, Dad, here's one of yours." And, of course, it's just by bad fortune. You know, there's usually other people in the video store and I have to slink out, you know.
Yeah, but there's that part of you that's like, yeah, that was kind of cool.
Oh, yeah. I mean, it's great to do something that your kids, you know, will, as you say, probably later in life respond to, and maybe it will help explain my personality to them. I think, gee, I wonder, Dad was irritable all the time. Boy, is he a, you know, a weird guy.
Oh, I'm sure that would never happen to a dad. So Terry, tell me this. How does a guy like you go from spending two decades turning out cinematic blockbusters, essentially, to dropping out of sight as far as, like I said, IMDb is concerned, and then a decade later surfacing with this amazing novel? What's, you know?
Yeah, that's after I finished From Hell, I worked on many other screenplays. You know, I did a movie for Disney. I did a movie for Jerry Bruckheimer. I did a movie for different movies for a lot of people. But I think, as every writer will, or every screenwriter will tell you who works in Hollywood, it's becoming increasingly difficult to get movies made. The studios are releasing far fewer movies. Those that they release tend to have massive budgets, massive advertising campaigns. The bets are much bigger than they used to be, say, two decades ago. So that was that's just the situation that we all confront. The second situation is that you very, very, very rarely write a movie by yourself, or with just one other collaborator. Yeah, I look at the credits now, you know, you can field a baseball team with you know, the number of credits, the writing credits. So it becomes harder to get your movies made, and that, when you've worked very hard on a screenplay, that's a very tough thing to confront. And it's also very hard to have any sort of personal vision of the movie. You know, it's, if you were to write, let's say, Avengers, you would be one of four or five or six people. There'd be producers, there'd be a director, of course, there'd be star actors. Everybody would have their opinion, and by the time it goes up on screen, you can be very proud of it, but I think it's very difficult to say it's your own work. So I kept working after From Hell, found it increasingly difficult for the movies to actually get made. I wasn't unique in that, and I'm not moaning about it. You get very well paid, you know. I mean, gee, everybody should have this problem. So I decided in my own sort of time, I thought, well, I'll work on the screenplays, but I'll work on this novel. And, so it became I Am Pilgrim, and it was good fun to write. I enjoyed it very much.
And how long did you actually work on the novel?
Well, yeah, that's very hard to say, because I kept putting it down. Jerry Bruckheimer's people would call and say, "We need another draft of this," so they would go aside for 6 months. I think really relentless work, I think it took about 2.5 years, but that was spread over, you know, 5 years or so. So, but, you know, it wasn't like I was kicking back at the beach, unfortunately.
How did it? I hate to focus on the length, but it is a substantial book in that regard. How did it come to be so long? I mean, a screenplay, generally 90 pages is a long screenplay. This is five or six times that. Tell me about that.
It was a relief. To sit down at the keyboard and feel like, oh, well, here we go. When I did the last, you know, major movie I wrote, which hasn't been made yet, but I believe it will, was for Jerry Bruckheimer. And I don't think I'm telling stories out of school here that when I handed the final draft in, I got a call from, you know, the president of production there and the other senior executives. And they said, look, it's terrific. It really is good. No, it's a wonderful thing. You don't hear that very often. They said, we've got one problem. And I thought, oh, here it comes. So this is how it always works. It's terrific. And it's a great Western. But what we really want is a period comedy, you know? When I say, oh, we've got one problem, you know, and they said, it's 123 pages long. And I said, yeah. And, you know, a lot of screenplays, yes, some are 90, but you can go to 120 and that would be fine. And they said, it's got to come down. And I said, oh, gee, you know, we've taken so much out. And they said, look, you've got to lose 3 pages. Four would be really good. And I said, what? And they said, Jerry won't read it. Jerry won't read it if it's more than 120 pages.
Amazing.
And I said, no. And they said, no, that's the rule here. And they explained it to me, and I think it was very valid. They said, look, Jerry's view is that if the writer can't be disciplined enough to do it in 120 pages or less, and given the expense to film every page of a screenplay, I mean, you're talking millions of dollars for 4 extra pages, if he can't be disciplined enough, if he's not concerned enough about the budget, then what are we doing here? The story should be able to be told in 120 or less. I listened to this and I said, you know, you're right. It can be done. Of course it can be done. I set to. I did it in a couple of days. And it forces you to think screenplays are much more like poetry. Maximum amount of meaning in the minimum number of words. And so you crank it down. Is everything essential? My friend George Miller, you know, Oscar winner, director of Mad Max. Happy Feet, lots of things. He says, I was talking to him about Iron Pilgrim. He said, oh, listen, Terry, he said, screenplays are Darwinian. It's the fight to survive. It's only the survival of the fittest as far as ideas, words, dialogue, everything. I think that's a perfect explanation for them. It is survival of the fittest. So you say to me, write a novel. And I think, ho, here we go. There's no stopping now. And I've written a lot of, big mini-series in my life, which tend to be much more epic in their scope. So I approach the novel more like one of the, not mine, but one of the great mini-series. And I say to people, yes, it's long. The point, though, is it boring? And if it's boring, then I failed. If it holds your interest for 600 pages, that's great value for money. Mm.
I generally, when I interview a novelist, I try very hard not to read, say, the last 40 or 50 pages. I don't want to know how it ends, so I don't have a chance to give it away. And I thought when I started reading your 612-page I Am Pilgrim, that will be easy because I'm sure I'll be exhausted after 400 or 500 pages. It'll be easy to stop. And I got to around 500 and I thought, I can read a few more. And then I said, oh, screw it. I got to read to the end. So people who watch the show regularly who know I say that generally, that I don't read to the end, I'm sorry. I couldn't help myself. I read to the end. It was interesting what you're saying about Bruckheimer, though, that I imagine it's different with him now that he's done television for some time, that he's probably more disciplined from those TV series where it is literally finite. You can't go to 61 minutes. And he's probably taken back some of that and applied it to films. Okay, although he still had overrun budgets on blockbuster movies and stuff. But it's interesting that he has that discipline. I admire that.
Yeah, absolutely. And I have to say, I'm not working with them at the moment or anything like that. They were by far the most intelligent, the most focused, the most disciplined production company I've ever worked with. It's no mystery to me all the success that company has had. And it was very interesting for a writer to work under those circumstances.
Did you want to mention how good looking Jerry is as well? I just want to throw that out because you probably do want to work for them again.
Well, I'd just like to say they're all good looking. is good looking. I was the exception. I think they took pity on me.
Yeah, right. All right. So how did the story of Pilgrim, I Am Pilgrim, how did it evolve? And did it change much from because it happened over several years in terms of your working on it. Did it evolve much over time?
Yes, it did, yes. And I think that's the most interesting thing about writing. You know, a lot of people put down really, really detailed plot synopsis. They have cards. They have all different systems. They work out every, you know, so-called beat to the story. Well, to me, that's not writing. That becomes typing. You sit there and you turn those outlines or those cards into, you know, a different form, and it can be published. What I like, and it's a personal thing, I'm not saying it's correct, but what I like is to sit there with a very clear idea of what major scenes are, what major set pieces are, what the ending is, and what the beginning is. And then I let the characters tell me what has to happen. So on the one hand, I'm sort of supposedly in control of it, but they're telling me what to do. So to me, it changed all the time. It was not one, you know, like, oh, well, this is the idea, and now I just sit down and just type it out. No, no, it evolved. Where did it start? I was living in Switzerland, and some very good friends of mine said, hey, do you want to come to a concentration camp? My wife and kids weren't there at that stage, so being a glutton for punishment and liking misery, I said, oh, yeah, sure, which one? I've been to some other ones. I've been to, you know, what are generally known as the, you know, misery with a guidebook tours. And they said, oh, this one's called Natzweiler-Struhoff. It's up on the French border. We can drive there in one, you know, if we leave early, we can get there in the, you know, by lunchtime and come back. I'd never heard of it. So I headed off with them and, you know, just a terrible, just, you know, well, you know, what can you say? But it's not a well-known one. Only 20,000 people or so died there. And but there was a photo in the little museum they have there. I mean, it's wonderfully restored. It's a fantastic place to go if you like that, if you can put up with that sort of thing. So many of the French resistance were actually incarcerated or killed there. But there was a photo there of a woman who was walking towards the gas chamber with her children. It wasn't actually at Natzweiler-Struhoff. It was in another concentration camp. And it was heartbreaking. You know, if you've got kids yourself and, you know, you have a reasonable sort of
moral
sensitivity. Yeah. And I looked at it and I thought to myself, you know, I would, in some way, I'd like to honor that woman and her memory. And that became, and I then said to myself, well, what would happen if a 12-year-old boy saw that? What effect would that have on him? And that started to give me the character of the guy who eventually took the code name of Pilgrim.
So I wondered about that because it seemed like that photo, of course, is a major touchstone in the book. It drives a lot of things that happen, and indirectly. I don't want to give the wrong idea. It's not a story about Nazi concentration camps. Not by any means. But it is a that touchstone in the book came from a real photo. That's interesting.
Yes, in a real place. I mean, it does mention in the book that this 12-year-old boy, you know, it just has a big effect on him emotionally. It's why I haven't taken my kids to those sort of places yet. But yes, and in the book, he walks up inside the electrified fence back towards, you know, the gates that lead out. And yeah, I mean, I took that walk and I felt those same things, you know, at the sun setting, the forest all around you. It was a spectacularly beautiful place, which made it even worse. And I took that walk, and I don't know, that's somewhere in a tortured mind, that started to mean something. It started to be a story.
Now, in the book, the main character, the hero, the anti-hero, however we want to describe him, Pete or Scott, depending on what point in his life he's, it's going to confuse people until they read it. But it's interesting because that photo is so important to him looking back and at the time that you would think that he is this sensitive soul with a very strong feel for family. But of course he's been adopted, and he's been adopted into this fam. I don't want to give too much away, but he's been adopted into this family. And the one person in the family who really seems to care about him and care for him, he's very cold to. And it's interesting that he was so touched by this photo, and I guess he comes to terms with it eventually.
Yeah, you know, there's that line about we never, you know, the ones we hurt the greatest are the ones we love. And, you know, I, in the midst of writing this, my own father died. And I think, you know, I probably, you know, I had, you know, like anybody would, very complex thoughts and emotions about that. Yes, he's, you know, Pilgrim is a guy who longs for love. But like so many people, he's not quite sure how to find it. And when he does find it, how to keep it and preserve it. And he says at one stage in the book that, you know, he wants to walk along a beach with somebody that, you know, he doesn't say it so boldly, but that he can love and not think about, you know, how far a sniper rifle can fire. That not think about the fact that, you know, you're dead before you even hear the sound. That's, you know, because the bullet travels that fast. All of these things that come from this life that in many ways chose him. So he has a... I wanted to do a character that was a little bit more complex than perhaps the average action hero. I've done those, and I felt like I wanted to do something with a bit more humanity.
Now, there is our hero in this book. Really, there's not a lot of sex. There's really no sex for him, as I recall. And it's interesting to go through that many pages. He's sort of in the spy business, in a sense, but he's not James Bond. He's not the suave, sophisticated guy. There's suggestion that he has periodic issues with substances. Doesn't seem to be a ladies man. In that regard, in a lot of ways, he's kind of the anti-James Bond, I think it's safe to say.
Yes, very much, very much. You know, the issue that he's dealing with is a cataclysmic attack on America, and in fact, the whole of the Western world. I mean, this is really, you know, just over the horizon science. Are we going to confront this? Yes. We will confront terrorists with, you know, highly developed biological weapons. You know, the tragedy of the Twin Towers is going to look pretty dial-up compared to the broadband that's coming. And I always felt that if your real function in life or your mission you're on is to save the Western world from that type of cataclysm, to start hopping in and out of bed with people, well... You know, I think the reader's going to say, well, I'm glad you're having a good time, but I'm worried about surviving. And I think most men, you know, all the people I've spoken to in my earlier life as a journalist who were in extremely intense situations, you know, either in war or confronting very, very difficult things, the libido, you know, nature looks after us. The libido takes a trip off the cliff. You know, you might be hanging around in a bar in St. Petersburg or in New York or wherever and thinking about sex. When your life and the fate of the Western world is very much in danger, I think the audience is going to say, oh, that's rubbish. Or the reader's going to say, that's like nobody would do that. Get on with the job. So that was my approach. It's not that I'm opposed to sex. I'd just like to make that point clear.
You do have children. You have four children?
Four children,
all right, so
yes.
We know you've apparently had sex at least four times.
Yes. Yeah.
Well, you know.
I think my wife got pregnant every time.
Do you worry, you know, excuse me, we talk about this biological weapons in the book, and I don't want to get into, I don't want to give away how, but it's very, the method, it's very frightening, and I think that's what kept me reading and will keep other people's reading, because you look at that and you go, yeah, that seems a little too possible to me. Does it worry that sometimes you write something like that and maybe you're actually giving someone, you know, a recipe for disaster that maybe they wouldn't have thought of on their own?
I wish that they couldn't think of these things on their own. They think of these things and far worse. Tom Clancy wrote a book, and I can't remember recall the name of it, but in which some people took control of some airliners and used them as, you know, fuel-laden missiles crashing into buildings. If, you know, the CIA and the FBI can't think of things that a a movie writer, a novelist, sitting alone in his little room can think of, then we're in really deep trouble. I'm sure that the intelligence services of not just America, but, you know, Britain and European countries are well aware of where the danger lies. I think the real problem comes from a commitment by the politicians to really fund the research. I'm not talking about, you know, listening in on people's phone calls and all of that, but most biological weapons are extremely difficult to make. Extremely difficult. There is one that isn't and is horrendously effective, and that's the one in the book. But that could be dealt with if we were to find a cure for that particular biological agent, and there's just no interest in it. And that's a tragedy. Hopefully somebody in Washington will read the book and say, hey, we should be thinking about this. That would make it all worthwhile.
It made me think a lot about it. I kept thinking, God, I hope somebody's in Washington thinking about this. There are a lot of, even in this conversation, there are a lot of 9/11 references in I Am Pilgrim. And the plot line is potentially apocalyptic. I think we can say that safely. Now, I didn't know that you had continued working on films after From Hell, because, as I said, maybe you need to have a publicist update IMDb. But the coincidence of you seeming to drop out of Hollywood around 2001, and then coming out a decade plus later with this incredibly apocalyptic, film. And I wondered, and of course you were living in Switzerland, we're talking to you today, you're in Australia. I wondered if there was any connection to the fact that you were not in Hollywood, and it was it just the coincidence of the 2001 From Hell, or is there some connection there?
Well, funnily enough, strangely enough, when the planes hit the World Trade Center towers, I was living in Florida. We didn't have any kids, and my wife and I were living in Florida, and I got up, and, you know, it's one of those things. It's like when JFK was assassinated, or John Lennon, you know, you never forget, do you? You just never forget where you were. And I was sitting in, walking around, you know, getting breakfast, doing whatever. You know, I'd been out in the office. I came in, I turned TV on, and I called to my wife, and of course we just sat there and watched it. It causes you to reassess your life. You know, I don't know many people who are happy in Hollywood. I really don't. There's lots of people who say they are. But it's a very insecure and very, you know, people worry an enormous amount about where they're seated in restaurants. And I'm not joking about this. I mean, I went to lunch one day with a very famous film director. And he turned to me and he said, well, it's pretty good, isn't it? And I said, oh, yeah, it's a nice restaurant. He said, no. He said, we've got the best table in this place. He said, now sitting over there is so-and-so. Sitting over there is somebody else. There are the senior agents from CAA. But we've got the best table. You know, come on. It's a table in a restaurant. I mean, this is not cancer research. I don't know many people that are happy because so many people are driven by fear and image and, you know, of course, you know, paychecks and many other things. Because I'm not American, my wife and kids are, I think I have a little slightly, you know, I have more of a view of an outsider of, you know, I'm an outsider to a lot of things. And I was getting to an age when, you know, when the planes hit the towers, and not particularly happy in Hollywood, but, you know, it's good life, you know, you get well paid, all of those things. I think it did cause me to reassess. I think that somewhere in the subconscious you're saying to yourself, is this what you always intended to do with your life? Is this what you were going to do? Or were you going to do something else? Do you really want to be on the phone to your agent all the time saying, well, who will be doing Avengers 3? Do you think that there's a chance there? And I thought, well, you know, I can write novels. You know, I've read an enormous amount, and I think I'm a pretty good storyteller. And I love reading. So I think it was no coincidence that a short time after that, my wife and I started to travel a lot more. And then I started to sit down and say, okay, let's get serious about this. And so I Am Pilgrim is the first of them. But fortunately, the publishers in every territory in the world that we sold, I think it's 21 now or something, most of them have done 2-book deals. So I have to do another one. It won't be a Pilgrim one, but I have to do another book.
Oh, well, all right. I want to come back to the next book in a minute, but a couple things. Where in Florida were you?
In Palm Beach.
Oh, okay.
So the other side to you. We've been living in New York. My wife's from California. And we went through one winter in New York, and she said, have you ever been to Florida? I said, oh, yeah. You know, I went down, I think, for one of the moon. I can't remember. For something to do with the space program and a few other things. And she said, I've never been there. She said, but it's very warm, isn't it? So we flew down and we looked around, and we bought a house there, which we've since sold. I love Florida. You know, I grew up at the beach in Sydney, so how could I not love it?
And that was my next question. I've been trying to before we started the interview, you mentioned the UK and the Commonwealth, and I thought, okay, you're not from there. You're living in Australia now. I'm going to guess that you were originally from Australia, but I actually didn't know. So.
Oh, no, I was born in England, but I came to Australia. I was born there, but I came to Australia when I was 5, as part of a big post-war migration boom to Australia. So my parents thought that it might be a better life for my brother and I, so they signed up, and for $20 you could come to Australia, and there's a photo of us which shows us getting on board the boat in Southampton in England. And when I first saw the photo, I didn't recognize myself in it. I thought it was a group of Polish refugees just after, like in 1946. I thought, who are these people? That's us. So, yes, we came to Australia, and it was pretty confronting for a 5-year-old. And my dad said, you should read. It's a wonderful thing. And so I started reading and sort of never stopped.
And did you say earlier that you were a journalist earlier?
Yes. After a mixed academic record, I was good at English and history. Math and science were not my strong suits. I thought, well, what's a sort of reasonably respectable job that you could do if you're no good at math and science? And I'd always wanted to be a journalist. So I very fortunately got a job at what is sort of like the Australian equivalent of the New York Times, of a newspaper called the Sydney Morning Herald. And so I did a traineeship there. You know, they supposedly taught me to be a journalist, and then in their madness, I'd been very fortunate. I'd been in the right place at the right time for a couple of pretty decent stories. When I was 21, they said, how'd you like to go to New York and work as a foreign correspondent? Mm-hmm. So I ended up landing in New York and doing the whole of Watergate and all of that. So, yeah, it was pretty interesting. And so I went from that to writing movies and then to novels, and now on with Mr. Media.
You'll probably have to retire after this, because what else could it possibly be in your career? Was that a Kerry Packer paper?
No, it was Kerry Packer was the competition. He was what we would think of as the more tabloid end of things. We were the more grey lady end of the stuff. But it was a very, back in those days, very, very vital newspaper publishing industry in Australia. Of course, like everywhere in the world, it's no longer the case. Mm.
And how do you explain kind of the differences between – it's pretty clear, I think, but just out of curiosity, between writing for newspapers, writing for film, and now writing for – fiction, long-form fiction?
There's a lot of differences, but actually the similarities overwhelm it all. If you do it well. I mean, we all know you can read great articles in newspapers or magazines, great journalism. Sometimes, not that often, we see great movies. and of course with great novels, it all takes the person who is receiving the information, either, you know, reading it or watching it, takes them on a journey. And the journey is always intellectual, emotional, and really retains your interest. So, I mean, I read journalism, which I think is outstanding on occasions, you know, and it always does that. It moves me to anger, to tears, to want to go and do something about it. But every paragraph holds your interest. It takes you on a journey. And that's what I think is the similarity. That's your job as a writer, whether you're working for a newspaper, whether you're working for Jerry Bruckheimer, or whether you're working as a novelist. You take the reader or the person who's receiving the information on this journey. And at the end of it, it feels complete. They say at the end of it, well, I understood all of that. There's no loose ends. There's no like, huh? What happened then? And, you know, of course, if you break that contract between you and the reader or the viewer, it's very hard to get it back. Mm-hmm. Very hard. So, you know, when you have a guy in a movie jump, you know, 400 feet off a building and he hits the awning of the grocery store and bounces off, lands on his feet and keeps running, I've always thought, well, that's a pretty big ask. Same in journalism. You know, you don't follow up something, you don't research it properly, you don't talk to the person that can really add some information to this. The reader reads it and thinks, I don't know, I'm not sure I believe all of that. So the similarities, funnily enough, outweigh all the differences. People think that, in my view anyway, that people think that writing novels is all about beautiful phraseology and wonderful descriptions. Yeah, that's important. But I tell you what, it's nowhere near as important as the story.
Right.
The story is the engine that drives it. And that's the same in journalism and the same in movies.
And did the former journalist in you guide you or steer you to be sure of things, making things factual in I Am Pilgrim? For example, whether it's the travel or the viability of moving virus from point to point, or building a virus, or the Saracen, who's the bad guy in this, gets medical training, and so many things happen. Do you worry very much in those details, or do you just go, oh, hell, it's fiction, I'll just, you know, play it fast and loose?
No, I'm incapable of playing it fast. I wish I could. Hmm. I'd be a lot quicker. I love the research. And people out there know so much. Somebody took me to task in a small review they wrote about, I said that there are tides in the Mediterranean. So, of course, this person says there are no tides in the Mediterranean. The worst thing you can do is to get into a debate with people about subjects like this. But, of course, there are tides in the Mediterranean. I've researched it. They're not very visible. The body of water isn't big enough. How many people would bother doing this? But I do, because I like knowing stuff. I like to feel like I'm in command of it. Is it all factual? No, of course not. It is a work of fiction. And that, no, you write nonfiction yourself. That's a different thing. You're working in much more narrow parameters than I am. If I choose to say there are no tides in the Mediterranean, well, it's fiction. I'm not asking people to rely on that when they're charting their course through the Mediterranean. I'm not going to feel responsible if they sink their boat from something. It is fiction. But in order to suspend disbelief, for the audience to feel immersed in the story, the reader to feel immersed in the story, they do have to feel that there are facts here that I can rely on. It's a very, very fine judgment where you abstract from those facts and the ones you keep. But I do, yes, I mean, ultimately it is a work of fiction, and, you know, and I say to people, well, you know, guess what? The Death Star's not coming. Darth Vader does not have, you know, ill intent. I know.
What?
Shock.
What? Well, let me ask you this. There's a writer named Richard Deutsch who writes. He has a series called The Thieves, and it's The Thieves of Legend and The Thieves of This, and they it's a globe-trotting series. It's suspense, it's adventure, thrillers. And I remember talking to him a year or two ago. One of his books starts out in actually in Turkey, Istanbul, I guess. It's in the Istanbul full Four Seasons, I want to say. And I was just amazed at the detail that he had about this hotel. And I thought, I said to him, you know, how much time did you spend there? And it was, in retrospect, it was a stupid question. But he said, oh, I never went there. He says, there's so much information available online. Now, you write about, and this is what I'm getting at, you write about Afghanistan, you write about Turkey, Iraq, Saudi Arabia, I'm missing a smaller country, kind of an Eastern did you visit any of these? Have you been to many of these countries?
Yeah, all of them.
Ah, okay. Now I can go back to asking that question in the future. It's just a fluke with Richard.
I haven't been to Saudi. I haven't been to Saudi Arabia. I sort of figure you got to draw the line somewhere. That's a bit too scary for me. When I was a journalist, I was, in some pretty nasty places. But Saudi, no, I didn't want to go there. And Afghanistan, I think if I had not been married with children, I think I would have been, prepared to go there for the research. I thought that was just too much to ask of the family. I wouldn't have put them through that anxiety. Everywhere else, yes, I've been to. Obviously quite a bit of it set in Geneva. I lived in Geneva. It's the island of Santorini, one of the Greek islands, yes. I've been there. Turkey, yes. Dubai, yes. America, of course. I lived, there many, many years. The UK, I've lived there. Germany, I've spent an enormous amount of time on and on and on. Yes, and most of them. But it is correct to say that there's a huge amount of information on the internet, and it would have been very difficult for me to have written this book without A, being very interested in research, B, having the sort of training of how to approach it, and C, the availability of it on the internet. If I can just give you a very, very brief example, I didn't know what currency they used in Syria. I knew they were Syrian pounds, but I didn't know what the other denominations were. Well, once I would have had to have gone into the big library in Sydney or in Geneva and hope I had something in English or whatever, or hope that the Britannicas I had at home would have had that. But in my experience, Britannicas never had anything you actually wanted. They had lots of information, but it was never what you really wanted. So the way I would have gone about it, I would have called the Syrian embassy. And I would have spoken to them, and then the CIA would have been listening to my phone call thinking, why is he calling the Syrian embassy? Is he trying to enlist? What is he doing? Instead of which, I just go, Syrian currency pops up, tells me everything I need to know. I insert that information, move on to the next thing. I believe it's changing reading and changing writing enormously. Why? Because had I got that wrong, everybody who's got a Kindle or a computer at home or anything like that, they say, not sure he's right about that Syrian currency. So you've got to be right. It's changing everything. The fact is that most people think that the internet is changing the publishing industry. Yeah, of course it is. But it's also changing how we write. Mm. And I think that's going to be a very, very long-term and huge change that we'll experience. We won't see it for a number of years. But certainly, I could never have written this book without the internet. Mm.
Well, let's come full circle. We've had you here for quite a while. I want to get back to a couple things. So you mentioned earlier that in a lot of parts of the world, you have a two-book deal. But you said the second book will not be another Pilgrim book. Now, As I read this book, you set up this recurring supporting cast of characters. It seemed to me that you were doing nothing but setting up If nothing else, setting up a sequel. I mean, you've got Battle Boy, the American who loves Japanese culture and is an enormous guy, and he's a computer hacker, can work anywhere in the world. You've got Ben Bradley and his wife Marcy, lovely woman, I'm sure. Ben, and by the way, it took me a while to catch on that Ben was African American. That was a nice touch. Who's the got the great moral center? He's a swell guy. He's an incredible detective. He backs up Pilgrim. You've got the Whisperer in D.C., his connection right to the top of power with the president. It seemed to me that you were doing nothing but, you were telling a great story, but I just thought, okay, I'm going to get another Pilgrim story in a year. So you're saying the next book is not a Pilgrim story?
No, it's not. Well, see, Bob, there's two more Pilgrims. There are two more Pilgrim stories. But I couldn't do one next in case this one didn't work. Emotionally, I don't think I could have coped with it. I didn't want to write a straight-out sequel to Pilgrim if this particular book had failed. I just didn't feel I could get the energy up. And you never know. Oh, yes, people always say, oh, I knew at the time this was, you know, incredible. Oh, well, I wish I had that level of foresight and confidence. No, so I did Pilgrim, and I thought, when I did it, in the deepest, darkest corner of my heart, I wanted to do The Lord of the Rings of the spy world. And you're quite right. Those characters would continue through the second book and the third book. And funnily enough, I know the exact ending of the third book.
I know what it is. Battle Boy eats everyone.
Absolutely, but as sushi.
As sushi, right. He would have to eat them raw.
So it's all laid out there. It's all, you know, capable of being done. But I also had to write a book that was a standalone book that would exist and work just as one novel. So that's what I did. But before it was published, before I even heard what publishers who'd contracted for it really thought about it, I started work on another book, which is at the moment called Year of the Locust, and it's set in the sort of spy world it is, but it's a much different story. And if I had my absolute choice in life, which we rarely get, but if I were to, I would do a Pilgrim, another book, a Pilgrim, another book, a Pilgrim, another book. Because I would like, should, you know, there be some success accrue to this, I'd like to be known not as a spy writer, I'd like to be known as a thriller writer. I'd like people to say, gee, that guy, can't remember his name, but that guy, he can really put you through it. Right. He can really take you on that journey, and you just keep turning the pages. That's what I'd like. Three of them I'd like to be Pilgrim books. It's out of my hands. Mm-hmm. It's really in the hands of the American public now.
All right. And was I correct in saying that the book has been optioned for film?
It hasn't been optioned formally, no. But there's been quite an amount of interest.
Okay.
In it. We're hoping that we're trying to hold off to see how it goes, you know. I mean, should it be fortunate enough to appear on bestseller lists or anything like that, that will change the nature of its movie deal. But, you know, that's not to say if Brad Pitt, you know, if Brad Pitt calls tomorrow and wants to play Pilgrim, well, you know, I'll make sure it's a screenplay of 119 pages.
Well, and that was my other question. Do you know any good screenwriters who could handle the story?
I don't know. It's hard. It'll be very hard. You'd need a very, very high degree of intelligence. You'd need to be sensitive. I can only think of one who would be my choice to do it.
So you will recommend me.
I was going to say, I think he's tied up writing another novel.
Okay. All right. Well, so I got to ask you a question about a guy who appeared in three of your films. You probably know this is coming, but I'm just I got to ask. I mean, Mel Gibson starred in three films based on based on your work. I assume at that point, when you get to a second and a third film with someone like that, it's not a coincidence. There must be he or someone liked working with you. Can you just give kind of briefly how you got involved in that world, and then how you got involved, and then maybe how you were no longer involved in that world?
Yeah, and how I feel about him.
If you insist, I'm curious. Yes.
No, I mean, everybody asks. That's a fairly common thing amongst, our group of friends and everything. I was working as a journalist, and I'd come back from America, and Australia's a very small country, so it's, big geographically, small population, so it's pretty easy to be well-known. You get your name in the paper and everybody knows you. It's not like America, where there's so much noise, there's so many people, it's such a huge country that to even get noticed is a remarkable thing. Australia's not like that. And so I was been working as a journalist and that, and this guy who is a doctor arranged to meet me through a mutual acquaintance. And he came and met me, and he said, "Oh, look, I've directed this movie. It's terrible, absolutely terrible. I want to write another movie. And, would you be interested in working with me? You're a writer, you're a journalist and all of this sort of stuff." I said, "Oh, yeah, I guess." And he said, "Well, come and have a look at this movie I'd done." And we looked at it, and I didn't understand. It was on a little screen in a corner of a living room out in the suburb of Melbourne, actually, here in Australia. And it had these fresh-faced kids in it, one of whom happened to be the star. And he said, "Well, what do you think?" I said, "Oh, gee, I don't know. There's a lot of stuff missing. It's a bit hard to follow the story." He said, yeah. "So it's hard to follow the story even with the stuff in there." I said, "Well, what do you think?" He said, "Oh, it's about 25% of what I imagined." I said, "Gee, that's a bit tough." And he said, "Yeah, tough thing making movies." Anyway, the movie was Mad Max 1. The fresh-faced kid was Mel Gibson, and it went on to have huge success. And then the screenplay I wrote with this guy, George Miller, became Road Warrior Mad Max 2. That was the first screenplay I ever read. I ever wrote, like Orson Welles. I started at the top and worked my way down. And he was a fantastic guy, one of the most intelligent people I've ever met. And we went on this journey about storytelling. So whilst we were writing Mad Max 2, I met the fresh-faced kid, who I had no idea when I saw that rough footage of Mad Max 1 that this guy would ever be a star. And, biggest movie star in the world he became. And I like Mel very, very much. I do. And I think he's had a very, very troubled life. And perhaps I know more about that than other people. I feel that he... For all the money and the fame and everything, I wouldn't walk 1 hour in his shoes. I can tell you that. I just wouldn't. So it's very hard for me because, as I often used to say to him, "Hey, I knew you before you were famous." I knew him when his eldest daughter, his grandfather now, when he was a baby, he was holding this little girl in his arms, And so we went through a lot, and I think that what happens in Hollywood when you've had successful experiences with people, they tend to call on you again. Not only have I worked on three movies that were made with Mel, I've worked on three others that weren't.
Oh.
So I've been through very, very, intense experiences with him, and I know a lot about, his background and the demons that he fights. Giorgio Santayana, philosopher, said that to understand is to forgive. And, I do know a lot of the criticisms that can be made. I know a lot of the where all of that's coming from. But I do have a level of understanding that I think most people don't, and that has led to a forgiveness of many things. It's a very complex relationship. I would feel less of myself were I to join the pile in on that. I have never, ever, nor would I have tolerated, and I don't think, and I think Mel would know that, I've never experienced with him, you know, the countless hours, the endless time we spent together, any of the things which, you know, have occasioned him to be criticized publicly. That's not something that I've gone through with mm-hmm. him. We worked and, you know, it's very intense, and I found him a wonderful actor to work with, but also a brilliant director. So that was my experience. I can't judge it by anything except that.
Because of what's happened to him in terms of his reputation in recent years and very, very negative things that have happened, could you ever see yourself working with him again because you've had this relationship in the past, or do you feel that it would not be a good career move for you to go back?
Well, I think there are things that supersede career moves, you know, friendship, loyalty, many, many things. I would have to feel comfortable about where Mel is, you know, emotionally, spiritually, all of those things. Do I want to expose myself to anti-Semitism? No, of course not. I mean, I think a lot of Iron Pilgrim shows that whoever wrote it's heartbreaks about the Holocaust. You know, so these things have all emerged publicly. It's post, you know, my last experience of working with Mel. I think he's been through a terrible time. I think Jodie Foster said herself that, you know, she counts him as a friend. And I, from what I've read, I have never spoken to her about this or anything, but that, you know, her experience probably mirrors pretty much mine. Do I think that I could work with him again? If we were in the right, he was in the right mental space and it was a great project, yeah, I mean, that's a possibility. Do I want to go and, you know, have to sustain lots of, you know, prejudiced thoughts? No, I don't want to do that. Life's too short. Mm. I try to bring my children up, you know, to have great humanitarian and, you know, good moral values. And, yeah, so I'm not going to expose myself to that. But I don't know what space he's in. I don't know how he feels about all of this stuff. That would have to be talked about.
So it seems like, if I could abbreviate that, it sounds like if you could work with the Mel that you once did 15, 20 years ago, and you didn't have to join the circus to do it, you would be interested in having that conversation.
Oh yeah, absolutely. Look, he's a highly, highly talented man. I mean, make no mistake of that. I mean, he really is. Mm-hmm. He's a, you know, multiple threat player as a producer, a director, an actor. You know, he's worked on so many scripts and stuff. So, yeah, it's a very, very complex thing. And you're right. My own feeling is that he's been through an absolutely terrible time, and I think it probably brought out, you know, alcohol does this, brought out some pretty bad things. I mean, very bad things. So, you know, it would be a subject of discussion. But there's a lot of people in Hollywood, let me stress this, there's a lot of people in Hollywood that if they thought that they could get a deal up or a movie up, they wouldn't give a damn about, you know, homophobic remarks or anti-Semitic remarks or anything like that. I mean, that's just, that's would be very common. I've been through too much to want to put myself through that. So it would be, as you say, where do we stand? What are his real beliefs? How do we, is there a way to move forward? If there isn't, there isn't.
If I ever go through a dark period of my life, I want a friend like you, or maybe you, to stand up for me just the way you did, because you stuck to your principles and you gave your old friend a little wiggle room. I hope I never get in that position, but I'd like to have a friend like you to talk just like that for me. So That was very nicely said. Whatever people think of Mel, I think the way you handle that is exceptional. So thank you for that. And Mel, thanks
well,
you for that.
Well, no, thank you for giving me the opportunity. You know, I was in London with him on one occasion. He was staying in a hotel just across from a place called Green Park, and we were working on a screenplay. And, you know, this is before all the madness of the latter years. This is, we go back 15 years or more. And I said to him, he was smoking a lot at that stage. You know, I don't think this is unfair to say that Mel is an addictive personality. So, you know, he can't just smoke two or three cigarettes. He has to smoke two or three packets. And I was trying to give up. And I've been really good, really, really good for months. I was sitting there and finally I said to him, "Hey, Mel, why don't we go and get a breath of fresh air?" He said, "Oh, yeah, that's a good idea." He said, "We'll go for a walk across this Green Park. Beautiful spring day in London." I said, "Oh, yeah, good." So we head out of the hotel. We run across Piccadilly or whatever it is, and we get into Green Park. So we're walking along. We're talking about the script, and there's nice fresh air in that. And we hear from quite a way away, "That's Mel Gibson." And then we see people starting to come.
Oh, God.
It was like from a movie. Mel, who's smoking so many cigarettes, but at least is reasonable, was reasonably fit. Me, smoked a lot of cigarettes, wasn't that fit. Sprinting across Green Park, I mean sprinting, like we could have got in the Australian Olympic team, I'm not kidding, with hundreds of people, hundreds, and I'm not exaggerating, chasing us. Until we got, there's iron railings along the side of this park. We had to find the gate, which thankfully he saw, get through the gate. The only thing that saved us was the traffic on Piccadilly, because we got through the traffic faster than they did and into the hotel. And I looked at him afterwards and I said, "You're nuts. Give it up. Give it up. Do some nice stage work. You know, 300 or 400 people come see you," because who'd want to be a movie star?
Oh, my God.
It was the worst experience I've ever had of what life is really like. And that was in London. I can only imagine what it would be like in America in those days. Not now, you know, with Mel, but back then, yeah. Biggest movie star in the world and your life is nowhere near your own.
Wow. Well, folks, listen. You can find Terry Hayes' first book, the outstanding novel, and I do mean outstanding. It's really a good read. I Am Pilgrim. In many parts of the world, it's already in bookstores, on newsstands. You can find it. It'll be in great bookstores in the United States and North America on May 27th, 2014, or you can pre-order it right now. At a great price at MrMedia.com, MRMedia.com. As a matter of fact, if you're watching the video on MrMedia.com, somewhere down here you'll find a picture of the cover, and you can just click on it right now. If this is before May 27th, you can pre-order it. Afterwards, you can get it to your Kindle. You can have it delivered Amazon. You know, they'll use one of those drones and deliver it to you in an hour. Or if you don't want to use the drone, maybe give him a day, give him 2 days. But you can have it. Just push the button, order the book. Terry, I don't know. Do you have a website? Are you online at all? Facebook, Twitter, any of those places?
No, the book is. I'm not. My wife won't allow it. She says I'm too easily distracted. She said you'll spend all your life on Facebook. And that. The office. No, so I'm not, but there is a Facebook page for I Am Pilgrim. There are Twitter accounts for I Am Pilgrim, and we do monitor them. And under my wife's name, Kristen Hayes, we answer them, and even the really bad ones.
Oh, very good.
So it's dialogue, but no, it's not. I don't have my own Facebook page. No, I can't be trusted with them.
I think your wife is probably a smart woman there. You probably would waste hours and hours. You could be making money writing books. So, Terry, it was delightful getting to know you and spending time with you. And I wish you much luck with Pilgrim, and I'll be looking forward to the eventual sequel. Thank you so much for joining us, Mr. Media, today.
Thank you very much for giving me the opportunity. It's been real fun.
Thank you. Thank you very much.